Hey, X-Files listeners, my buddy Mike Murphy and I have teamed up for a new podcast, Hacks on Tap. Every Tuesday, we'll be breaking down the latest developments in the race for the White House. We'll give you our insights as campaign veterans from both sides of the aisle who've seen presidential politics from the inside and the top. We'll even have a few special guest hacks along the way. Here's our most recent episode. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find Hacks on Tap on the new Luminary app, which is the only place you can find new episodes of The Axe Files. The Luminary app is free to download and has shows like Hacks on Tap, plus premium ad-free shows, including The Axe Files, a new show from Trevor Noah, plus Fiasco, the new show from the co-creator of Slow Burn, about the 2000 Bush versus Gore recount. For more information, go to luminarypodcast.com. Now please enjoy Hacks on Tap. Cheers.
Hey, pull up a chair. It's Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy.
So, you know, it was funny, Axe. I was watching a little television, and I thought my house might burn down because so many sparks were coming out of my cable TV as all the hyperventilating that the campaign has hit the rocks for two of the candidates. And, you know, these were important moments, but these things have a lot of moments, and maybe voters are a little more patient than those of us who watch it
Patient, or they're actually living their lives. They're not hanging on every development of the campaign. I mean, we relearn this lesson every campaign, which is that voters focus late because they've got other things going on in their lives. And, I mean, activists are focused. There was just an AP poll out in the last day that said only 35% say they're paying close attention to the campaign, and only 22% of Democrats say they know a lot about the candidate's position. So, first of all, this underscores why these debates this week could be, important in terms of people tuning in, getting acquainted. But secondly, it underscores what we know, which is that all these events that become the decisive events on cable TV often come and go. But we had a couple last week, and I think the important thing is I always judge these events in terms of what lessons do they teach us about these candidates or campaigns, less than is this going to be the end of a campaign. So we had two candidates struggling. Yeah. Pete Buttigieg, the young mayor of South Bend, Indiana, was had to get off the campaign trail because there was a police-involved shooting in his town that roiled the great divides that we've seen in cities across the country, and he struggled to deal with that issue. His town hall meeting in South Bend, probably the first town hall meeting in South Bend, Indiana, that was televised nationally, which is a reflection of how well he's doing. But listen to a little bite of this.
The effort to recruit more minority officers to the police department and the effort to introduce body cameras have not succeeded, and I accept responsibility for that.
Do you understand? Get the people that are racist off the streets. We want the body door to the department. You can do that by Friday.
Yeah, he's learning about life in the faster lane when you go from 1% world near the top. You know, I took a couple of things away from all this because, you know, it, as you say, it's not only a measure of the thing, the problem, but how they endure it and how politically adroit they are at handling it. And I was a little surprised. I mean, it really hangs a lantern on his big problem, which is the all brains, all head, no heart. And I thought, you know, he was doing kind of the McKinsey problem solver, and he was taking responsibility, kudos for that. But he didn't really emotionally connect to the pain, which is a skill you need as president. The other thing that amazed me is they have known this is coming for a long time. Not this particular shooting, but other problems in the police department. They have that issue with the tape that
he fired the African-American police chief.
Who was very popular.
Who was taping other officers secretly because he thought they were making racist comments about him.
And arguably illegally, which is, you know, why the tape is tied up. But I saw one of the things that Mayor Pete did this week or last week was he went to the ceremony for the new rookies, and there were, I think, five or six white officers sitting there. And I thought, why not have somebody who's politically smart, or why didn't they, back at home getting in front of stuff they know is coming? Because if you're a governor or a mayor, an executive job, and you're off at the Hog Festival running for president, trouble is always going to pop up back home, and you need to have a good team on top of things to get in front of them, and there appeared to be none of that.
Yeah, well, they would argue that they tried and failed. That's what he said. I don't think that's going to satisfy many people. The problem for him is that he has seen as a great challenge for his campaign the ability to break in with African-American voters. He's still down at 1% with that group. He's done better among whites, and this is going to set him back in that way. But the bigger thing is the thing you point out, which is Pete Buttigieg has already demonstrated that he's got the intellectual capacity to hang with the big dogs here and to do the job. The question is the other part of the job, that ministerial part of the job that requires you to connect with people on an emotional level. You know, we don't know. We don't know if he can get there. And this was a setback. I will say one thing, though. For 2 hours, Americans saw him actually doing a job, talking about a grave situation, and that is, you know, it underscores the fact that mayors have real jobs. You're not flap-jawing all the time. You're not debating. You're not trading jibes. You're dealing with real things. And that, if there's a silver lining around this in this cloud, that is it. But undoubtedly, and we'll talk about the debate in a minute, this will come up on Thursday night when he's on that debate stage. And it's not something that he necessarily anticipated having to deal with in this setting, not the thing that he wanted to focus on.
Well, totally. And the way it shakes that up is he probably wanted to do generational stuff vis-a-vis Biden and Bernie. Now it's going to be racial relations night. Kamala is going to be there to give him a few lectures, and he's either going to be excellent at it, which he has to be, or he's going to stumble some more and it'll get worse. And we all know the law of gravity in a Democratic primary. If you cannot connect to black voters, you're not going to be the nominee at the end. So he's got a lot of running room, but he is now in the business of moving this needle, or the Pete momentum is going to stop flat.
The issue of race also intruded on the Biden campaign because of a comment that he made. He made what I thought was a very important point, which is you've got to be able in a democratic system to deal with people whose views you don't always embrace and sometimes whose views you deplore. But he chose a terrible example and talked about how he worked well with two virulent racists and segregationists and Jim Eastland from Mississippi and Herman Talmadge from Georgia. And in the course of making that comment, which was at a fundraiser, which is pretty much where you see Biden speaking, he made a reference to the fact that Talmadge called him son. He didn't call him boy. And this inflamed Cory Booker, who saw an opportunity to jump into the debate. And it occasioned a question from Al Sharpton after an event in South Carolina. So let's listen to that.
Mrs. King said to me, you can't say things that hurt people. It hurts when you talk about boy.
It
means something different to us.
It
hurts when you call a racist like you normalize. You're not, that's not the Biden I got to know. Don't you understand?
No, I do fully understand. That's not what I said, though. They didn't print the whole deal. You know what I mean? You know, I do understand the consequence of the word boy.
So to me, the problem is it's not that he's a, I mean, Joe Biden is not a racist. I don't think he's insensitive to these issues. And, you know, he is sitting there with 60% of the African-American vote, largely by dint of his association with Barack Obama. But it does speak to his repeated habit of talking himself into a jam. I mean, this was just tone deaf.
It's a tremendous contrast with Mayor Pete, who if Buttigieg is all head and no heart, Biden is all heart and no head. There's no language discipline. He just kind of emotes. I mean, you know, the poor Biden, because he wants to be Reagan. He wants to have that Irish twinkle in his eye, connect to voters outside the Democratic base to win the general, do well in Trump counties, you know, connect emotionally to people. But he's really Bob Dole. And when he is allowed to, and I'm, by the way, a huge Dole admirer, but when he speaks from the heart, he gets back to legislative history and backward-looking stuff and wants to tell stories about bipartisanship and, you know, how he worked with people. It all comes from a good place, but it is not particularly what I think Democrat primary voters may be looking for. So the question is, if you're in the Biden campaign, you have the horrible vice. On one hand, do we try to make a hero out of the fact that, oh, Joe talks from the heart, he's not scripted, he's authentic, but you're going to have this roller coaster? Or do you put him in a straitjacket and watch him wiggle around like Houdini trying to escape? Neither is optimal. The middle is the best, but that requires a language discipline that Biden just might never be able to achieve.
Yeah, well, I think they've made their decision. That Al Sharpton interview was only the second interview that he's done on television. He did one with The View right after he got into the race. And, you know, so they are keeping him in a cocoon here, trying to have as little opportunity to make these kinds of mistakes. But I've said it before, I'll say, yeah, I don't think you can get away with that throughout this campaign. And he, you know, he is going to have to use this campaign to prove that he can handle it. And that he hasn't lost it, that he's not past his prime. And you can't do that if you're in a protective program here. But
totally, the cocoon campaign is always a nightmare too, because the press narrative is, look, he's got two fingers out now, he's wiggling. He's doing something, you know, he's trying to blink now. They cover anything but the message because they think that's fake. And the whole story is, can he escape? And by the way, Biden will escape. The best cocoon in the world can't not let Joe Biden be Biden. You know, older guys have been in politics a long time, don't change. Biden will talk about bipartisanship forever, to his credit, but maybe not to the joy of the campaign would like to get him on. Well,
if you're
going to
talk about it, just don't talk about it and use segregationists as your foils for the story. That was the tone-deaf part of it, you know? I mean, I think this bipartisanship thing is central to his message, and it'll either fly or it won't fly. Won't fly with young activists, probably. But choose the right examples. And this has been a problem throughout his career, but it could be exacerbated by the fact that the man is 76 years old.
Exactly. I think there is something for him if he framed it as, I've been in the good fight my whole career, and I've won a hell of a lot more than I've lost. Here's how. You know, so you kind of explain the benefit of doing some of this stuff rather than launching into, I'll never forget in 79 when we made that deal with Strom Thurmond. It just may be a little too old school. These master legislators, the Scoop Jacksons, the Bob Doles, potentially the Joe Bidens, the Ted Kennedys, they don't always transfer well to the requirements of being a modern presidential candidate. Maybe that's a tragic thing, but that has been the reality.
And, you know, he grew up in a time when you had to go to the post office to buy stamps. But that's no longer true, is it?
No, it's not. You know, it's weird. I was working on a transition too. He better not mail it in, but it is true. Look, I go to the post office a lot. I like sending letters. I like sending notes, but it
you never send me
hassle.
One, man. I have not gotten a note from you. I'm a little upset to hear that you are a note writer.
Once upon a time, I think I did, but it probably didn't get through the Secret Service there. I'm on the list of dangerous letter writers. But anyway, the post office, there are so many things you can do, but it is a hassle to go. So what's amazing about, here it comes, stamps.com, and I've actually used stamps.com in my business. It's a real time saver because it adds efficiency, because you can literally have like the post office in the drawer of your office.
That's right. Whether you're a small office sending invoices, an online seller shipping out products, even a warehouse sending thousands of packages a day, stamps.com can handle it with ease. You can do it all right from your computer, and you can buy stamps as well without leaving your home, and they'll get sent to you, and you get 5 cents off every first class stamp and up to 40% off priority mail. So it's a good deal.
Exactly. And you know what? Because you and I know people, our listeners are going to get a special offer that includes a 4-week plus free postage trial and a digital scale, which is pretty cool. It's not enormous, too, so it adds to the efficiency. Anyway, you get all of that without any long-term commitment. All you got to do is go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in those magic words, Hacks on Tap.
Stamps.com, enter Hacks on Tap. You're going to love it so much, you're going to want to send us a note. So before we get to the debates, we have to check in on the President of the United States. another wild and woolly week, and it continues into this week. It looked like we were about to engage militarily with Iran. I'm glad we didn't. But according to the president, we were 10 minutes away when he learned that there'd be civilian casualties, and so he held back after the shooting down of an American drone. I find it mind-boggling to think that's how it actually went down, and I don't think it probably did go down that way. But by today, he's back, and he is promising to obliterate Iran if they do anything to respond to the new sanctions that he just put on yesterday. I mean, it's whiplash, but does it have any political implications?
He also got the name of the Supreme Leader wrong, saying he was cracking down on the dead guy, who's, of course, busy voting in your home city right now. So I don't know.
Slander.
I couldn't resist the old Cheap Chicago gag, despite the fact that
They never get old, do they?
Yeah. You know, it's a great town. Look, I think it was total kabuki theater where he invented this thing that, you know, when it's all about the people for me. I think this was classic Trump, where the rhetoric is always irresponsibly bellicose and the actions are timid. I mean, he wants to be the peace and prosperity candidate, and he has enough kind of animal cunning to understand that if he gets into an escalation chain, he has lost control. And then all of a sudden, a lot of his life over the next 2 years is dealing with the various conflicts we could have with the Iranians. So I don't believe any of the story he told. I think because he'll never be on the cover of Grand Strategist magazine, I'm glad he didn't start an escalation chain without knowing where to end it. And I have a secret theory quickly that the Korean thing has informed a lot of thinking around the world. There's an outlaw regime making a lot of trouble, horrible people. They act up a little, and what do they get? They get a summit and the legitimization they crave for decades. So the Iranians, who have been pushed back away from the nuclear deal, do a lot of bad stuff, I think have decided to poke around, make some trouble, and then send the back channel that, boy, we need a big peacemaker to come over here and, you know, make a deal, which, of course, would liberalize trade and give them everything they want. So this could turn into North Korea, too. We'll just have to wait and see.
He also gave the Saudis a hall pass for the Khashoggi assassination this week. All of this sends signals to the world. My question was, does it send any signals to American voters, or is it just maybe what your answer was, if he had actually gone to military strikes and this thing escalates into a military engagement, that is bad for him, and therefore he will not go there.
Yeah, I think, you know, you win the beginning because you're the commander in chief, but then you live with it for a very long time. And again, as the peace and prosperity candidate, it's not in the reality script. But we'll see. If the Iranians keep pushing, he's in a corner now. And there is a point where we cannot let them fool around the Straits of Hormuz. I mean, they're acting up looking for, I think, attention, not conflict. They've been rational in the past, but if not, they will get conflict. Though I think the first casualty of this whole adventure will be the guy who really would like to light it up over there, which of course is Mr. Bolton, who, if I were him, I would Google Steve Bannon, because now that I turn on television and see the master strategist, you know, Bolton is driving everything, that's not a good career plan.
The leading man doesn't like that. Just to sum it up, I think Peter Baker said it best in the New York Times when he said Trump has turned the old Teddy Roosevelt adage on its upside down, and he believes in speaking loudly and carrying a small stick, and you know, so we'll see how the American people process this and where this crisis goes. Talking about stress, everybody feels stress at times. Now there is this thing called Talkspace. Tell me about Talkspace.
Well, it's interesting because it's mobile. It's an online way to get therapy. So it makes taking care of your mental health a lot more convenient than ever before. You provide your preferences for therapy, and Talkspace will match you with one of 4,000 therapists they work with on the very same day. So it's quick. You can send that therapist unlimited text, audio, picture, or even video messages from anywhere on your mobile device at any time. So no matter what you're going through, it's always good to be able to get some help, and this allows you to do it. More than 1 million people have felt happier with Talkspace.
Talkspace has more than 4,000 licensed therapists who are experienced in addressing the challenges we all face. And to match with your perfect therapist for a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, go to Talkspace.com. Make sure to use the code TALK to get your first week free and show your support for this show. That's T-A-L-K and Talkspace.com.
You know who might be looking for a little therapy and a little support after the next week or some of these candidates in the huge debate, David? There can't be 20 winners.
Yeah, well, it's good there are 4,000 licensed therapists because then there'll be one for every Democrat
for every candidate.
Yes. Yeah.
So
we got two nights, yep, right?
Huge cast of characters. Night two was particularly big because you got a lot of front runners. But night
so
one
let me ask you
really
about
be
wait, before
Elizabeth
you go
Warren
on. Let me ask you about this. The Democratic Party, I think rightly, along with the networks, decided that the last campaign with a big Republican field was kind of a farce where people were limited by their standing and they had like a junior varsity game and then the main game. And it was demeaning to the people in the JV game. And it also constricted their ability to grow. And you didn't see them interacting with Trump and others. This time they did it by lottery. But this weird thing happened, which is now you've got there are five people who are clearly top tier right now, and those include Biden, Bernie Sanders, Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, and Kamala Harris. Four of the five are on the second night. Elizabeth Warren is alone among those on the first night. What do you think that means?
You know, I think it's pretty good for her. She'd probably like to be in the big debate, but she'll be able to run wild. She'll get most of the questions because she's rising up. The question will be two things, I think. One, the kind of middle leaguers, like you said, the Klobuchars, the Betos, the Cory Bookers, you know, they need to get something happening or the finance machinery in their campaigns will run to a halt and there's no fuel to try to increase the voter support. So they're going to be itching to do something. And then you got the old ham and eggers at 1%. And I think the two to watch there, because they're both talented, are Ryan, the congressman from Northern Ohio, who's kind of a blue-collar hero. And people are going to laugh in New York, but don't underestimate Bill de Blasio. He is incredibly comfortable with the language of the progressive left. He's used to that New York media circle. He's a scrapper. He'll attack people. He's tall. He may get a little notice there trying to break through in night one. Night two, well, that's the big show.
Yeah, well, just on the night one point, I assume that Warren will, her plan will be plans, that she'll continue down this road of sharing her ideas about how to deal with problems. I don't know, had she been on the stage with Joe Biden, I think she would engage with him directly. I don't know if she will engage with anybody on this stage. The question is, who will engage with her? A lot of the people you mentioned are people who, other than de Blasio, are running as more center-left candidates. Will anybody take a shot at Warren for being too left to win a general election?
You know, I think there's a shot of that because Klobuchar, who really needs to jumpstart here, she has been working a little to the right of some of the others. She's not for some of the healthcare stuff. So there will be obviously questions right at that premise with Elizabeth Warren. Are you too liberal? And that's an opening for Klobuchar to try to carve out some space. Now, I'm not sure carving out the right is the recipe in a Democratic primary these days, but it's something. And yeah, my guess is her finance stuff. You know, we're going to get the new finance report at the beginning of next month. And she probably needs something to happen to jumpstart that. So that could be her opening.
Well, the right is still left of center in in the parlance of larger politics. But she, you know, I think her problem is that Biden is taking up a lot of her space. His argument is that I can speak to white working class voters, that I'm a moderate, that I can work across party lines. That's very much her message as well. But she could use Warren as a foil for some of that. The other question to me that I'm going to be watching closely is what Beto O'Rourke does. You know, he started off as the flavor of the month after the election of 2018. There was a lot of enthusiasm about it. He's lost momentum. He's in that. He is a one percenter in some of these polls or close to it. He also probably is struggling on money now and needs to develop refine his identity in this race? Why is he running? The other one is Booker, and they'll be flanking Elizabeth Warren, Booker and Beto. Booker is a very charismatic guy, African American, got an interesting record from Newark, but he hasn't broken through here. What does he do to break through? I mean, these are... Yeah,
that's the question. You know, they're both performers. Beto and Corey have both done well in the smaller arenas of their home state. So you never want to totally bet against somebody who's had a hit record before not having a hit record again. I think Corey will be a little frustrated because he engaged with Biden, which was good for him. And now Kamala is going to be able to kind of take his act and go score with it on the big debate. But I think they're both going to be on the balls of their feet trying to break out with something. Amy has that ideological move. I'm not sure what the Beto move is. It might be the kids at the border, an issue he's been strong on. And Corey, you know, he is a talent in search of a bit of a message, and maybe he'll break through. We'll see, or at least get something going.
But all of the people you mention are people who are stressing their ability to reach beyond the Democratic base. Even Cory Booker has made that a focus. So if there is any sort of conflict, even oblique conflict in this debate, I think it will be between the idea of a candidate who speaks strongly to the Democratic base, as represented by Warren. You mentioned de Blasio. He doesn't have much of a base right now, but he does speak to the base, and some of these other candidates who may make the argument that the Democratic Party has to go beyond that.
And it may be for them smart because it's a better finance fundraising argument, you know, process oriented than a pure voter hearts and minds in the primary. But that's okay. Amy needs money to get something going in Iowa to break through and the voters. So for them, probably first on their mind are the 5,000 to 6,000 donors they want to try to connect with who can go raise, you know, significant money for them. Beto has that fundraising base through the internet. Maybe he can re-energize them. Now, so night two is the
night two. No, night two. That's the one where all the other top tier people are, and the front runner, Joe Biden.
Titan night. And you got Bernie, who's got to figure out some way to get back in the race because, you know, in the last 3 months, he's essentially been a meal for Elizabeth Warren.
Well, this is my theory. My theory is that he has already basically proclaimed that he's going to go after Biden in many different ways, on his vote for Iraq, on some of his economic positions, on the notion of bipartisanship. You know, my feeling is that his target is as much Elizabeth Warren as it is Biden, that he wants to reclaim the mantle of the left, and he's going to use Biden as a foil here. One of his problems is it's virtually the same attack that he ran against Hillary Clinton, and he runs the risk of sounding like a golden oldies album there.
Yeah, you know, I remember in the last primary, he was not that good at attacking. What Bernie likes to do is his speech. You know, I remember when he shook up the media team and made his own ad, he got the camcorder and put it on the table and basically did his stump speech. So will he be adroit at the back and forth and kind of grinding down? I do think Biden has an opportunity. The one good thing about being beat up for 2 or 3 weeks through self-inflicted mistakes is the expectations are low. And he may break through if he's really good on race, if he's prepared, if he has some, again, long shot, but some language discipline. Who knows? Biden could kind of overachieve a little. I think Mayor Pete is the biggest loser so far because he's not going to get the easy generational thing. He's going to have to talk race. And Kamala has a real path into dominating a lot of the debate because a lot of the topic will probably be race relations.
The only top-tier woman there as well. Just getting back to Biden for a second, apropos to what I said before, I think he, you know, this is a two-hour debate. He needs to stand up there for 2 hours and look engaged, vigorous, like a guy who should be the front runner. I think that's as important as anything. I think the optics of how he performs is going to be as important as anything he says. Of course, he can't make mistakes. If he makes a mistake, that will exacerbate concerns. But, you know, I think just enduring and looking fresh and like he belongs up there for 2 hours, and that will get him a lot down the field. And the second thing is to be able to signify that he's thinking about the future and not just reminiscing about the past.
Totally.
The sepia tone thing is not good.
Yeah. The legislative review, and I'll never forget what happened in 74 in that subcommittee.
For Mayor Pete, yes, you're right. I think now he has to deal with the issue at hand. How he deals with it is both a challenge and an opportunity. If he deals with it in a way that is impactful and strikes a chord with people and looks like a guy who's dealing with real-life issues, as I said before, he could benefit from it, but it certainly changes the stakes for him. For Kamala Harris, I think the thing, she has an electric quality. She is charismatic. She has that it thing. The thing she's been lacking is a coherent message. I don't think people, they can tell you what Elizabeth Warren is about. They can say Pete is a new generation candidate. Biden is the guy who can beat Trump. Bernie is Bernie. But it's not really clear what Kamala's message is. This is an opportunity for her to burnish that message.
Totally. And I think the real test will be, we know she'll be powerful and dominate the debate on race. Can she then pivot to take it to the next step and not be one note? In other words, kind of have the best of both worlds. That's the opportunity. And I couldn't agree more on Pete. If he's smart enough to know that he's got to go in there and dig out of the hole he's in and really achieve. And if he does it, he'll be back in business. If not, then he's going to be stuck in this problem for a while.
Well, I'll tell you, no one knows more about the impact of debates and the aftermath of debates and the process of getting ready for debates than my old pal Stephanie Cutter, who was the deputy campaign manager of the Obama campaign, was the communications director for John Kerry in 2004. So who better to talk to in this pre-debate moment than Stephanie? Stephanie, always good to be with you, especially on the eve of debates. We've done that before. tell me what's going on in based on your experience. We've all had them in these among these legions of campaigns and candidates who are getting ready?
Oh, I would imagine that people are doing some mock debates today with lots of people on stage, but primarily trying to figure out either who's going to come at them or who they need to go after, and practicing how you do that, what the moments are, what the pivots are, and what you want people to be left with.
One of the things they must be working on is trying to keep these answers to 60 seconds. I remember how we struggled with that with Obama.
Mm-hmm.
That was not his forte, and he didn't like it. But it's hard. You know, they're used to getting a ton of time, and now they have, you know, they're going to get gonged.
Right. I think it's going to be a particular challenge for people like Mayor Pete and Beto, and who are really known for, you know, their thoughtful answers, which are not confined to 60 seconds. Other people are going to be more disciplined about it. I have a feeling that Elizabeth Warren is going to pass the test pretty mightily.
Yeah. What about Biden?
You know, Biden, we know he's long-winded. However, he's a good debater.
Yeah, he
is. This is not his first rodeo.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, what about the experience of having been on these stages before?
Right. In 2007, 2008, he did a number of them. And it's hard to debate 10 people, or I guess 9 plus you, on the stage at once. In terms of the, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about, I had a candidate ask me, well, what would you do? I said I tried to find a way to turn the conversation back to yourself, you know, whether that's through an attack on someone and their rebuttal, and then it comes back to you. Try to find a way to pull the conversation back to yourself because of such a limited time.
a natural skill for most politicians, and I think that will be the instinct, because they're going to figure out pretty soon it's not really a debate, it's a joint appearance. What would you tell Bernie, who's kind of lost a little momentum to Elizabeth Warren? She won't be there on night two, but he and Biden are both trying to hang on to something while others are moving up. What kind of advice would you give Bernie on what to do, how to use his time?
Well, I think that everybody is expecting the Bernie versus Biden show, and how Bernie is going to define himself compared to the center-right candidates, which would be Biden, who's taking up the most oxygen, as well as Beto and probably Mayor Pete. You know, what would I do if I were Bernie? I would be detailed about the plan that he's put out. He is the only one that has a detailed plan for Medicare for All, which is, a big piece of how he's defined. Healthcare is such an important topic. And it's really, Medicare for All versus the others who want to keep a pathway for private insurance, take a staged, phased-in approach, whatever it is. It's really Bernie versus everybody else in that regard. Everybody says they're for universal care coverage. Everybody says, a lot of these guys have signed on to his Medicare for All bill, but a lot of them have also walked back the idea of eliminating private insurance. So I would find a way for Bernie to go hard on that, particularly against Biden, who is not for Medicare for All.
Yeah, one thing about Biden that strikes me is the timing of this Iran flap may play into his hands. What he's selling is experience. He's the guy who can go up against Trump. He's the experienced, seasoned leader, and he certainly is experienced when it comes to national security. And I'm sure he's going to try and find a time when he can face off with Trump in absentia over this issue of his handling of Iran.
Right.
So it's a little tricky.
That could definitely.
No, go ahead, Stephanie, and then I'll weigh in.
I was just going to say that could really be a moment for him, particularly because, he spends a lot of time talking about Trump, and Iran is fresh on everybody's minds. So is the border crisis.
Yes.
So those two issues will definitely dominate. It'll be interesting to see on all of them, not just Biden, how many of them bring Trump in on a regular basis to define who they are and what they stand for. I think there's a danger of doing that too much, but I think we can certainly expect it from Biden.
Yeah, I think the border crisis will be a bell ringer, but a problem Biden has doing wise man of foreign policy is
Iraq.
Trump spoke like Trump, and then he acted like Biden. He wasn't rash and he went to the edge. And then again, Iraq too. So we all know that a lot of quote unquote winning a debate is winning the week after the debate, because that is the noise that drives the national polling, which will all be affected by this, if you give it a week. How does that work? And what are staffs thinking about the minute the debate is over?
Well, I can tell you what I would be thinking about. I would, going into that debate, know the three things that I'm going to pull out of it and hope like hell my candidate
hits
those three things and executes. But those are my three things.
And pray for two out of
spin
three.
Room. or I'll just create some fake news. But walk into the spin room, push those three things, and for the week after, figure out how you're amplifying that through events, through new announcements, through things that can drive the news, expand on the message a little bit. That's going to be harder for some of the on the cusp type candidates, who are not in the top tier. But for Biden and Warren and Sanders and Mayor Pete and even Beto and, Senator Harris, they should be thinking about what's the 5 to 7 day strategy, not just what's happening on that debate night.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Stephanie.
No, I was just going to say advertising comes into play here too. And David, you and I know this, and Murphy, you've done it on the other side of us. But I'm thinking back to the first debate of President Obama against Mitt Romney. what a disaster that was. But we pivoted pretty quickly and went up with advertising the next day, did a early morning event and drove messaging out of the night before and continued it. And, you know, it was hard to pivot from...
That was called disaster mitigation.
It was disaster mitigation.
Change the channel because you got to.
But, you know, one of the things, Stephanie, that's changed since, and Murphy and I have been at this longer than you, but you've been at it a while. But, you know, you were involved with Kerry in 2004. The role that social media plays, even during the debate, is a whole different dimension than we've seen in the past. And do you imagine these campaigns are setting up social media batteries to try drive? Because reporters do look at Twitter and they're writing their stories.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the reporters do look at Twitter, but reporters are reporting out what they think about the debate in real time on Twitter. That's how we realized how bad that first debate was going for us.
Right. In 10
back
minutes.
In 2000. And in 10 minutes into the debate, we knew we had lost.
This is
going to
happen again because Trump is going to be live tweeting the debate. And I think one of the middle level candidates could make a smart move by responding in real time to a Trump tweet with the right forceful response, because Trump will not resist trying to participate in this thing. And there could be an opportunity there for somebody.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, I would if I were the campaign, the campaign can be communicating in real time with your supporters and not so much the media. The media narrative is going to be so quickly. It's going to be very hard for anybody to influence that unless you have a big breakout moment, or unless your name is Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, or Elizabeth Warren. Think about your supporters and what you want them to be left with and how you communicate with them outside of the lens of the media. And you know, focus there a little bit.
Before we let you go, how important do you think this first set of debates is? What will the impact of these be, particularly for those candidates on the bubble and those beyond the bubble who are, you know, what I call the one percenters, the people who are 1% and lower? How important are these two nights?
They are really important, and for different reasons for everybody. And it's still early, and there's going to be a lot more debates. We know that. But for people who are struggling to get over the 1% and know they're going to have a challenge getting on the debate stage in September because of the change in threshold,
right.
It's a really important night to figure out how you break through and then how you amplify it. I mean, Julian Castro is... You know, he performs well at these forums or on the ground at events, but it's really hard for him to break through the media narrative. If he has a good night, that could mean lots of money for him, but also lots of support. So it's really important for the 1%. For those that are in the second tier looking to move up, you know, again, if you're not Bernie or Biden or Warren.
So Beto, Booker, Klobuchar.
Beto, Booker, right. Then, you know, I think that you want to be presidential. You want to show that you can beat Trump. You want to show that you have the experience and the vision and have a plan for the future and can be that person who can take Trump on. You know, for Biden, you know, he's got some cleanup.
More than a little. It's a nightmare when your big goal is to survive, to get a little fundraising going by exceeding the margin of error, where you don't statistically even exist. And the problem with those candidates is they can clog everything up because they're, you know, doing tap dances or magic tricks desperate for attention. And the bigger players watch the clock tick away.
My guess is that Biden will overperform people's expectations because he does have the experience.
Yeah.
Anyway, let me just say, you are one of my favorite hacks, Stephanie, and you are now one of us. And we're happy to have you.
It's a privilege.
And we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks for coming.
All right, thanks.
I bet a lot of candidates wish they could get a little debate insurance. And insurance is something people procrastinate on. I know I do. It's just, it's wearying at times. Well, procrastination on insurance can actually work in your favor. For example, if you need life insurance, but you've, like all of us, has been putting it off, congratulations. You've managed to procrastinate just long enough for technology to make it easy.
Couldn't agree with you more. Not the thing I love doing most. So anything that makes buying insurance easier is good. And Policy Genius is the easy way to shop for insurance online. In just 2 minutes, you can compare quotes from top insurers to find your best price. And Policy Genius doesn't just make life insurance easy. They can also help you find the right home insurance, auto insurance, and disability insurance, if not debate insurance.
So candidates, anybody, loyal listeners, if you need life insurance but have been busy doing literally anything else, check out Policy Genius. It's the easy way to compare all the top insurers and find the very best value for you.
PolicyGenius.com. Nobody wants to shop for life insurance. That's why they made it easy.
Well, Axe, it's time for mailbag. Our listeners who we love, we'd like to hear from you at hacksontap@gmail.com. I think we got a couple of interesting ones this week.
We got a bunch of interesting ones. I wish we could do them all. It's a smart group of people. So we got this question from Caroline that is really at the heart of a debate within the Democratic Party. She said, though the popular vote is trending solidly towards the left, the Electoral College makes it such that rural and typically more conservative voters have an outsized voice in electing our next president. How do Democrats break through to these voters, and how essential is it for Democrats to make inroads with some of these rural voters to win the 2020 election? This is a thing you hear a lot. You know, Trump won Wisconsin, Milwaukee didn't vote. Trump won Michigan by 11,000 votes. Detroit had a very light vote in that election. Young people did not vote in large numbers in 2016. Is the challenge to mobilize the base, or do you have to do a little of both? I'm in the little of both category. What do you think?
Well, I've got to start with a quick historical question. You know who invented the Electoral College? Alexander Hamilton. That is the one song that didn't make the musical. What the hell were we thinking? It would have been a hit.
This is just to prove that Murphy is college educated. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, Correspondence College. So I'm of the school that a little bit of both, but if there it is a choice between running up San Francisco another 100,000 votes or getting into some of those far suburban, exurban counties and rural counties full of kind of older, cranky white voters, it is obvious that that is where the fulcrum of the election is. And I think one of the things that Dems have to figure out is while all the short-term incentives in the primary are often, or at least perceived to be, to capture the progressive vote, the regular vote is watching some of these debates too. And they got to be careful not to give Trump too many tools, because I don't think, you know, some of these issues...
And he will be live tweeting, by the way.
Oh, my God, totally. Trying to hijack it. But if you're in Pasco County, north of Tampa, or Macomb County, places Trump did really well, Luzerne County, Wilkes-Barre, they ought to have those voices in the back of their head, because this is not about running up the score in New York and California in the general.
So Robert, who says he's a graduate of Mike's high school,
Go Blue Devils. Yeah.
Yeah.
Grosse Pointe Park.
Asked this question, would you agree that Iowa and New Hampshire having outsized influence in the nomination process is unrepresentative of America? I'd say this is particularly true on the Democratic side, where we rely on two largely white states to select a candidate for our majority-minority party. You hear this question a lot as well. I have to say I'm a defender, maybe because Iowa thrust Barack Obama toward his election, and it was Iowa's embrace that really launched him as a candidate. But there is something about these states and the process within these states where candidates actually have to meet voters and actually have to respond to questions as candidates for other offices would, and has to interact and has to appeal on a kind of retail basis, that I think is important. And,
I'm with you on that. It's a gauntlet they have to run. In theory, at least, if you have a good message and a good set of snow tires, you can actually make some progress rather than an auction. Though in the modern era, with Boston TV being so important in New Hampshire and Iowa being a caucus, which is pretty narrow, you know, that has a bit of an effect too. But fundamentally, the idea of two small states, followed, by the way, by the very diverse Nevada caucus and, of course, South Carolina.
And then you're into Super Tuesday, which is really a national primary now.
Right. It's the best system, although I'd like to see on the Republican side an Iowa primary and a New Hampshire primary. New Hampshire would go ape over that. They shouldn't. They'd still be in an important place. But the caucus is a narrowing deal.
So we heard from our old buddy Mark McKinnon, a living legend, a legend hack in his own right, who we have to get on this show. And he said, I know you couldn't be paid enough to go back into the human microwave. He speaks from experience. But if you had to, which campaign would you least want to helm? And you can go first. I imagine Trump would be at the top of your list, huh?
Oh, yeah. I've been anti-Trump since 92, all these Johnny-come-latelys. But I would say, just to live vicariously on the Democratic side, it would be Biden. Because you got to hold the front runner position and you got to force a guy you're going to be pretty fond of, I think, as you get to know him, to do things that don't fit who he is, because who he is, the backward looking legislator, is not really what they're looking for. So it would be a grind of discipline all the time defending the front. So that would be, I think, a joyless march. I feel bad for my friend Steve Ricchetti, who's a good guy and loves Joe Biden and is doing everything he can for him. But that one's a hard lift. It's the little guerrilla insurgent campaigns that are more fun. The Buttigieg's, the Warrens, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, the joylessness is a really important point. Campaigns, I remember when we started the Obama campaign, and one of the first things that he said to us as a group was, look, this is deadly serious. Presidency is it's the most important job on the planet. We're trying to make change here, but he said there should be joy in the pursuit. There should be, and if there's not, we're doing something wrong. And I have to say, it was a joyful, even on the bad days. We had a good time. We had a good time with each other. One of the things that I think reflects some problems in the Biden campaign. I said it last week, but we saw it again in this incident with. His comment about the segregationists is, you saw a lot of comments from unnamed staff after the fact saying, well, we tried to tell the old guy not to do it, but he did it anyway, so on. That is a bad sign for a campaign. A campaign that is working properly doesn't have that kind of leaks. I couldn't imagine doing that in the Obama campaign. Everything was within the family. And there wasn't this kind of dissonance. So that would be a concern. I mean, there are other, you're absolutely right that it is great to be the insurgent. I've had that experience. At some point, an insurgency that goes nowhere it can be a dispiriting experience too. And I think, you're going to see some of these candidates fall by the wayside come fall for lack of money, lack of invitation to the fall debate stage, lack of traction. I wouldn't want to be over there either.
Yeah, it is the great thing, I've never had more fun in my life than working with McCain in 2000. And the fun
which
is
was one of the legendary
nowhere.
Campaigns, that,
Well,
I think
you.
About it often because you guys put the press on a bus with McCain and they literally talked to him from morning to night. I mean, it's almost unimaginable now.
Well, authenticity was our calling card, and we had nothing to lose. That's always the mother of campaign invention. The problem is it starts working, and then the forces of empire pivot around and out-resource you to death. So it often ends in tears, but it's the best ride you can have. So I just want to quickly echo on the staff thing with Biden. That is a horrible cultural sign. Somebody's head ought to roll, because what it really says is the staff are all thinking about their next gig, not about how to die trying for Joe Biden. And it is a troubling thing, and Biden deserves better.
Okay, let's wrap it up. Oh, sorry. That's absolutely, and it'll be interesting to see if they can tighten things up. So that's about it for us now. We will be back with a special edition of Hacks on Tap in the morning after the Thursday debate to just wrap up what we've seen and see how smart or not smart we were in this pregame show.
We love you people. So we're going to be up in the middle of the night. And so in drive time on Friday morning, you can hear our debate reactions. That one's coming up. So if you like it and want to get our chatter in front of more people, please rate us well on iTunes. That is how their algorithm decides who gets on the front page. So if you want to spread the news about Hacks on Tap, you can sure help us with a good rating on iTunes.
And algorithms rule, we know that. And keep your keep those notes coming to hacksontap at gmail.com, because we you're sending us great stuff, and we want to hear from you.
So we'll see you after the debate, X. See you on Friday.
All right, brother. Thanks.